Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Our 30-minute program of news and stories from around the world is designed for people learning English. So we speak slowly, using a simple style and limited vocabulary. Today, we hear from Phil Dierking and Alice Bryant. We close the show with An American Story by O. Henry. But first, this report from Susan Shand.
Among the things that the Centeno family of Venezuela brought to Brazil is a lot of a natural fiber called fique. I knew we were going to need it, said Maria Centeno, whose age is unknown, even to her children. She and her family are Wadao, a name that means boat people. They are members of an indigenous community that lives in the Orinoco Delta of Venezuela. Other community members live in nearby countries such as Guyana and Trinidad and Tobago. The Wadao use fiber taken from the leaves of the fique to make hats and other products. Since the Centeno family arrived in the city of Boa Vista in northeastern Brazil, they have earned money by selling their handmade goods. They have also resold copper and asked strangers for donations. The family lives in the Pintolândia shelter in Brazil. More than 600 Venezuelans from indigenous tribes are staying in the shelter. It receives money from Brazil's government and non-governmental agencies, such as the United Nations Refugee Agency and the Adventist Development and Relief Agency. The shelter was once a sports center. Hundreds of hammocks provided by the non-governmental organizations are hung in the open space for places for people to sleep. There are also several large tents where Venezuelan migrants and refugees live and rest. At the end of each day, the children play football in a cleared space. The Wadao are one of the indigenous groups who have been forced to leave Venezuela because of its economic and political crisis. UN officials say food shortages, rising inflation, and violence in the country have forced them to cross borders in search of humanitarian aid. Venezuela is home to about 20,000 Wadao. Jesus Gutierrez, chief of his Wadao tribe, says that the situation in Venezuela was difficult for his community. We are farmers and artisans, but there is no one who buys our products in Venezuela, he said. But not many people in Brazil are buying either. The Centeno family say their products are not selling well. Most of the time, family members have to ask for money on the street. Some men have asked younger Centeno females for sex in exchange for money. The men arrive and show you the money. Once a guy told me, "You're so pretty. What are you asking for money?" said 19-year-old Erica Gonzalez. Wadao tribes are made up of several families. Gutierrez's, for example, has 600 members, of which 75 are in Boa Vista. Indigenous peoples usually travel in large family units, notes Helena Suders of the Adventist Development and Relief Agency. Her agency provides migrants with products needed for cleaning and cooking. Chief Gutierrez says that sometimes problems arise in the camps. "We are not used to sleeping like this, all together," he said, adding that he has to watch his possessions closely so they are not stolen. But, he also said, the camp is better than Venezuela, where he could not feed his family. I'm Susan Shand.
The U.S. Air Force is getting close to completing a base in northern Niger for armed drones that will target militant groups operating in the area. Auburn Davis, a spokesman for U.S. Air Force Europe and Air Force Africa, told VOA that the base is the biggest U.S. Air Force-led construction project ever. The total proposed cost of building the base is $98.5 million. The base is in the northern city of Agadez in the Sahara Desert. There, militants and smugglers find ways to go to and from Libya, Algeria, Mali, and Chad. About 650 military members will be deployed to the base once it is operational. The U.S. military said an undecided number of military drones, including MQ-9s, will also be sent to the base. They are currently being used at another drone base in the capital, Niamey. The U.S. military says it decided to build the base in Agadez in partnership with the government of Niger. Nigerian Defense Minister Kala Muntari confirmed that his government requested the Air Force's presence to help the country in its fight against terrorists and international criminal groups. Some experts believe the construction of the base is a sign that the Sahel area of Africa is becoming increasingly militarized. William Asanvo is a West African coordinator at the Institute for Security Studies Africa. He told VOA that the future base raises some concerns about foreign powers taking roots in the Sahel to pursue national interests that are not always clear. Nigerian officials consider the Agadez base important for dealing with the growing security threat of terrorism in Niger and nearby countries. Niger's Defense Minister, Kala Muntari, said the area between Agadez and his country's border with Libya is large and unpopulated. Militants are able, in his words, to move about freely there. He added that militants also use the area to move weapons. Asanvo said he believes the move to Agadez could also be part of the U.S. military's effort to have a quiet presence in the area without leading to opposition from the local population. "This is important," Asanvo said, "given the clear opposition a significant part of the Nigerian population has voiced about the increasing Western presence in the country." I'm Phil Dierking.
Welcome to Ask a Teacher, a new program where readers ask questions and teachers answer them. Some of the first words English students learn are I and me. But even native English speakers do not always know which one to use in a sentence. In today's Ask a Teacher, Fernanda from Brazil gets right to the heart of the problem. Here is her question.
Sometimes I don't know when to use I or me. For example, I want to tell someone that I made some food with a friend. How can I say it? Monica and I made the food? Or Monica and me made the food?
Hello, Fernanda. I can tell that you know to use the word I when you are the only subject of the sentence. You correctly wrote I want, for example. In this case, I is the subject and want is the verb. But you are asking about a situation involving two people, you and your friend. Let's review what you already know to find the answer. I is a subject pronoun. It refers to the person performing the action of a verb. Use I for the subject of the sentence. Me is an object pronoun. It refers to the person receiving the action of a verb. Use me for the object of the sentence. In your sentence about cooking, are you and your friend the subject or the object of the verb made? In other words, are you the ones making the food, or is the food making you? You are making the food, of course. So the answer to your question is, Monica and I made the food. In this sentence, the whole subject is Monica and I. Let's look at a few more sentences with I as part of the subject.
In September, Monica and I are starting classes. When can Monica and I visit the new museum?
And sentences with me as part of the object.
What did you bring back for Monica and me? David is giving Monica and me a ride to the airport.
If you're still not sure whether to choose me or I, try keeping just the pronoun. Listen.
What did you bring back for I?
You would not ask, what did you bring back for I? The correct way to form the question is, what did you bring back for me? Then you can just add the other person back to the sentence, what did you bring back for Monica and me? And that's Ask a Teacher. I'm Alice Bryant.
A retrieved reformation. In a prison shoe shop, Jimmy Valentine was busily at work making shoes. A prison officer came into the shop and led Jimmy to the prison office. There, Jimmy was given an important paper. It said that he was free. Jimmy took the paper without showing much pleasure or interest. He had been sent to prison to stay for 4 years. He had been there for 10 months. But he had expected to stay only 3 months. Jimmy Valentine had many friends outside the prison. A man with so many friends does not expect to stay in prison long.
Valentine, said the chief prison officer, you'll go out tomorrow morning. This is your chance. Make a man of yourself. You're not a bad fellow at heart. Stop breaking safes open and live a better life.
Me? Said Jimmy in surprise. I never broke into a safe in my life.
Oh, no, the chief prison officer laughed. Never. Let's see. How did you happen to get sent to prison for opening that safe in Springfield? Was it because you didn't want to tell where you really were? Perhaps you were with some lady and you didn't want to tell her name. Or was it because the judge didn't like you? You men always have a reason like that. You never go to prison because you broke open a safe. Me? Jimmy said. His face still showed surprise. I was never in Springfield in my life. Take him away, said the chief prison officer. Get him the clothes he needs for going outside. Bring him here again at 7 in the morning. And think about what I said, Valentine. At 7:15 on the next morning, Jimmy stood again in the office. He had on some new clothes that did not fit him and a pair of new shoes that hurt his feet. These are the usual clothes given to a prisoner when he leaves the prison. Next, they gave him money to pay for his trip on a train to the city near the prison. They gave him $5 more. The $5 was supposed to help him become a better man. Then the chief prison officer put out his hand for a handshake. That was the end of Valentine, prisoner 9762. Mr. James Valentine walked out into the sunshine. He did not listen to the song of the birds or look at the green trees or smell the flowers. He went straight to a restaurant. There he tasted the first sweet joys of being free. He had a good dinner. After that, he went to the train station. He gave some money to a blind man who sat there asking for money, and then he got on the train. 3 hours later, he got off the train in a small town. Here, he went to the restaurant of Mike Dolan. Mike Dolan was alone there. After shaking hands, he said, I'm sorry we couldn't do it sooner, Jimmy, my boy. But there was that safe in Springfield, too. It wasn't easy. Feeling all right? Fine, said Jimmy. Is my room waiting for me? He went up and opened the door of a room at the back of the house. Everything was as he had left it. It was here they had found Jimmy when they took him to prison. There on the floor was a small piece of cloth. It had been torn from the coat of the cop as Jimmy was fighting to escape. There was a bed against the wall. Jimmy pulled the bed toward the middle of the room. The wall behind it looked like any wall. But now Jimmy found and opened a small door in it. From this opening, he pulled out a dust-covered bag. He opened this and looked lovingly at the tools for breaking open a safe. No finer tools could be found anyplace. They were complete. Everything needed was there. They had been made of a special material in the necessary sizes and shapes. Jimmy had planned them himself, and he was very proud of them. It had cost him over $900 to have these tools made at a place where they make such things for men who work at the job of safe breaking. In half an hour, Jimmy went downstairs and through the restaurant. He was now dressed in good clothes that fitted him well. He carried his dusted and cleaned bag. "Do you have everything planned?" asked Mike Dolan. "Me?" asked Jimmy, as if surprised. "I don't understand. I work for the New York famous bread and cake makers company. I sell the best bread and cake in the country." Mike enjoyed these words so much that Jimmy had to take a drink with him. Jimmy had some milk. He never drank anything stronger. A week after Valentine 9762 left the prison, a safe was broken open in Richmond, Indiana. No one knew who did it. $800 were taken. 2 weeks after that, a safe in Logansport was opened. It was a new kind of safe. It had been made, they said, so strong that no one could break it open. But someone did, and took $1,500. Then a safe in Jefferson City was opened. $5,000 were taken. This loss was a big one. Ben Price was a cop who worked on such important matters, and now he began to work on this. He went to Richmond, Indiana, and to Logansport to see how the safe breaking had been done in those places. He was heard to say, "I can see that Jim Valentine has been here. He's in business again. Look at the way he opened this one. Everything easy, everything clean. He's the only man who has the tools to do it. And he's the only man who knows how to use tools like this. Yes, I want Mr. Valentine. Next time he goes to prison, he's going to stay there until his time is finished." Ben Price knew how Jimmy worked. Jimmy would go from one city to another, far away. He always worked alone. He always left quickly when he was finished. He enjoyed being with nice people. For all these reasons, it was not easy to catch Mr. Valentine. People with safes full of money were glad to hear that Ben Price was at work trying to catch Mr. Valentine. One afternoon, Jimmy Valentine and his bag arrived in a small town named Elmore. Jimmy, looking as young as a college boy, walked down the street towards a hotel. A young lady walked across the street, passing him at the corner, and entered a door. Over the door was the sign, "The Elmore Bank." Jimmy Valentine looked into her eyes, forgetting at once what he was. He became another man. She looked away, and brighter color came into her face. Young men like Jimmy did not appear often in Elmore. Jimmy saw a boy near the bank door and began to ask questions about the town. After a time, the young lady came out and went on her way. She seemed not to see Jimmy as she passed him. "Isn't that young lady Polly Simpson?" asked Jimmy.
"No,"
said the boy.
"She's Annabelle Adams. Her father owns this bank."
Jimmy went to the hotel, where he said his name was Ralph D. Spencer. He got a room there. He told the hotel man that he had come to Elmore to go into business. How was the shoe business? Was there already a good shoe shop? The man thought that Jimmy's clothes and manners were fine. He was happy to talk to him. Yes, Elmore needed a good shoe shop. There was no shop that sold just shoes. Shoes were sold in the big shops that sold everything. All business in Elmore was good. He hoped Mr. Spencer would decide to stay in Elmore. It was a pleasant town to live in, and the people were friendly. Mr. Spencer said that he would stay in town a few days and learn something about it. No, he said he himself would carry his bag up to the room. He didn't want a boy to take it. It was very heavy. Mr. Ralph Spencer remained in Elmore. He started a shoe shop. Business was good. Also, he made many friends, and he was successful with the wish of his heart. He met Annabelle Adams. He liked her better every day. At the end of a year, everyone in Elmore liked Mr. Ralph Spencer. His shoe shop was doing very good business, and he and Annabelle were going to be married in 2 weeks. Mr. Adams, the small-town banker, liked Spencer. Annabelle was very proud of him. He seemed already to belong to the Adams family. One day, Jimmy sat down in his room to write this letter, which he sent to one of his old friends. "Dear old friend, I want you to meet me at Sullivan's place next week on the evening of the 10th. I want to give you my tools. I know you'll be glad to have them. You couldn't buy them for $1,000. I finished with the old business a year ago. I have a nice shop, I'm living a better life, and I'm going to marry the best girl on earth 2 weeks from now. It's the only life. I would never again touch another man's money. After I marry, I'm going to go further west, where I'll never see anyone who knew me in my old life. I tell you, she's a wonderful girl. She trusts me. Your old friend, Jimmy." On the Monday night after Jimmy sent this letter, Ben Price arrived quietly in Elmore. He moved slowly about the town in his quiet way. He learned all that he wanted to know. Standing inside a shop, he watched Ralph D. Spencer walk by. "You're going to marry the banker's daughter, are you, Jimmy?" said Ben to himself. "I don't feel sure about that." The next morning, Jimmy was at the Adams home. He was going to a nearby city that day to buy new clothes for the wedding. He was also going to buy a gift for Annabelle. It would be his first trip out of Elmore. It was more than a year now since he had done any safe-breaking. Most of the Adams family went to the bank together that morning. There were Mr. Adams, Annabelle, Jimmy and Annabelle's married sister with their two little girls aged 5 and 9. They passed Jimmy's hotel, and Jimmy ran up to his room and brought along his bag. Then they went to the bank. All went inside, Jimmy too, for he was one of the family. Everyone in the bank was glad to see the good-looking, nice young man who was going to marry Annabelle. Jimmy put down his bag. Annabelle, laughing, put Jimmy's hat on her head and picked up the bag.
"How do I look?"
she asked.
"Ralph, how heavy this bag is. It feels full of gold."
It's full of some things I don't need in my shop, Jimmy said. I'm taking them to the city to the place where they came from. That saves me the cost of sending them. I'm going to be a married man. I must learn to save money. The Elmore Bank had a new safe. Mr. Adams was very proud of it, and he wanted everyone to see it. It was as large as a small room, and it had a very special door. The door was controlled by a clock. Using the clock, the banker planned the time when the door would open. At other times, no one, not even the banker himself, could open it. He explained about it to Mr. Spencer. Mr. Spencer seemed interested, but he did not seem to understand very easily. The two children, May and Agatha, enjoyed seeing the shining heavy door with all its special parts. While they were busy like this, Ben Price entered the bank and looked around. He told a young man who worked there that he had not come on business. He was waiting for a man. Suddenly there was a cry from the women. They had not been watching the children. May, the 9-year-old, had playfully but firmly closed the door of the safe, and Agatha was inside. The old banker tried to open the door. He pulled at it for a moment. "The door can't be opened," he cried. "And the clock, I hadn't started it yet." Agatha's mother cried out again. "Quiet," said Mr. Adams, raising a shaking hand. "All be quiet for a moment. Agatha," he called as loudly as he could, "listen to me." They could hear, but not clearly, the sound of the child's voice. In the darkness inside the safe, she was wild with fear.
"My baby," her mother cried. "She will die of fear. Open the door. Break it open. Can't you men do something?"
"There isn't a man nearer than the city who could open that door," said Mr. Adams in a shaking voice. "My God, Spencer, what shall we do? That child, she can't live long in there. There isn't enough air, and the fear will kill her." Agatha's mother, wild too now, beat on the door with her hands. Annabelle turned to Jimmy, her large eyes full of pain, but with some hope, too. A woman thinks that the man she loves can somehow do anything.
"Can't you do something, Ralph? Try, won't you?"
He looked at her with a strange, soft smile on his lips and in his eyes. "Annabelle," he said, "give me that flower you're wearing, will you?" She could not believe that she had really heard him, but she put the flower in his hand. Jimmy took it and put it where he could not lose it. Then he pulled off his coat. With that act, Ralph D. Spencer passed away, and Jimmy Valentine took his place. "Stand away from the door, all of you," he commanded. He put his bag on the table and opened it flat. From that time on, he seemed not to know that anyone else was near. Quickly, he laid the shining, strange tools on the table. The others watched as if they had lost the power to move. In a minute, Jimmy was at work on the door. In 10 minutes, faster than he had ever done it before, he had the door open. Agatha was taken into her mother's arms. Jimmy Valentine put on his coat and picked up the flower and walked toward the front door. As he went, he thought he heard a voice call,
"Ralph!"
He did not stop. At the door, a big man stood in his way. "Hello, Ben," said Jimmy, still with his strange smile. "You're here at last, are you? Let's go. I don't care now." And then Ben Price acted rather strangely.
"I guess you were wrong about this, Mr. Spencer," he said. "I don't believe I know you, do I?"
And Ben Price turned and walked slowly down the street.
You just heard the story, The Retrieved Reformation, by O. Henry. And that is our show today. We will be back tomorrow, same time, same place. Hope you can join us then. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for listening.